What is cool is a very good question, and we're not talking weather here either. Cool is protection. It's a stance toward reality. It is anger stuffed so deep, lives are spared. Whether it got its start with African slaves in America or with African-American jazz musicians, whether it's personified by George Washington, Jackson Pollock, or Charlie Parker looked like Buddha, Charlie Parker, who recently died laughing at a juggler on TV after weeks of strain and sickness, was called the perfect musician. And his expression on his face was as calm, beautiful, and profound as the image of the Buddha, represented in the East, the lidded eyes, the expression that says, all is well. This was what Charlie Parker said when he played, all is well. You had the feeling of early in the morning, like a hermit's joy, or like the perfect cry of some wild gang at a jam session. Wail, wop, Charlie burst his lungs to reach the speed of what the speedsters wanted, and what they wanted was his eternal slowdown. A great musician and a great creator of forms that ultimately find expression in mores and what have you. Cool is important to poet Lewis McAdams. He's a poet, for one, a pure poet, a world heavyweight champion poet, so cool comes natural to him as busting syntax. But in tracking the history of cool, he looks back on his own life in a very easy read entitled Birth of the Cool, Beat, Bebop, and the American Avant-Garde. It's our pleasure to welcome to the cool Northwest the very cool Lewis McAdams. Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, it's cool to be here.
That's cool to have you here, definitely. You know, the book, as I said, it's an easy read, and I look forward to reading it. From the very moment you look at the book, it's a beautiful, it's really a work of art in all aspects of that term.
Well, when I set out to do this book, I wanted to write a book that wasn't just about cool, but was actually cool itself, and so I really reached out. I spent a couple of years looking for the right photos. In most of the cases, I got the photo I wanted. There's a few cases where I couldn't afford it, or I couldn't get the rights to it. But this book is you could learn almost everything that this book is about just by looking at the pictures.
Yeah, and a chunk of your advance went to getting some of those shots.
Yeah, I spent probably half my advance. No, not half, about a third of my advance on the photos.
That's brutal.
I know. I hope it was worth it.
Oh, definitely. It's a book that people can be reading for a long, long time. Now, to get a sense of your first exposure to cool, we go to the very uncool suburbs of Dallas, Texas.
Yeah.
And radio plays a part.
Absolutely. The first time I ever think I heard the word cool was from this DJ named Jim Lowe, who was he called himself the Cool Fool, and he was a white guy playing rhythm and blues. After I would listen on my old wooden radio after the Dallas Eagle baseball games, and he would come on, and his theme song was Buddy Morrow's Night Train. I lived in the white suburbs, and I grew up during segregation, and the only black people I knew were people that worked in my parents' yard or washed dishes or cleaned our clothes. And so, this was a way that I could begin to explore black culture, was through music and the world of cool, that I didn't even know about or even think about. But when the guy that suggested that I write this book, I had never thought of cool, but as soon as I started getting into this book, I realized I'd been obsessed with it since I was about 8 years old. So it became a kind of autobiography disguised as a cultural history.
And as a child, basically, in Dallas, you heard this, you knew it was cool, and it somehow resonated with you. You knew that there was something to that.
Yeah, well, it was the music. I mean, it was blues. It was rhythm and blues. I mean, this is what we're talking about now in the early 50s when there was electric blues. I mean, T-Bone Walker was around, and Muddy Waters had gone electric at that point. But there was still so much of a connection to the Deep South and to the pre-electric South that it was a way for me to start to get in touch with my roots, even though, I grew up hating white people, and it was because of segregation and because of I just hated white country music, and I just, you know, and this was the music that seemed to me to be real, you know, was the music I was hearing from the Cool Fool.
You hated white people because of what was going on with segregation, yeah, with racism, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I came from a relatively liberal background, and my parents didn't use the N-word, you know, but they were the only people I knew that didn't. And, you know, so it was just like I felt alienated from the first time I was conscious. And, you know, and as I discovered in researching this book, is that the people that became my heroes as I got older were aliens. I mean, they were people that they were on the very fringes of our of American culture, and cool comes from the edges. And that's what this book is about. It traces the idea of cool from the edge to the center.
Yeah. It was a friend's suggestion that you write the book, and then you started thinking, that's a good idea.
I thought, the second he said it, I said, I want to do this. Well, actually, we wanted to make a television show out of it. He's a film producer and produced a lot of great movies like Mean Streets and The Last Waltz and Under Fire and a few things like that. And when he was young, he had been Bob Dylan's road manager. And so he had a fan's appreciation of music. And he'd seen a movie that I'd co-produced and co-directed called What Happened to Kerouac, which is a biography of Jack Kerouac. And he said, let's make a movie about cool. And nobody wanted to do it. And then I just said, well, if no one's going to want it to be a movie, I'll just try to write a book about it. So
yeah. You quote writer Marlene Kim Connor in the book as saying, cool is about defiance. You think defiance is the essence of cool?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think that cool is, I think there's a lot of truth. I mean, as I was writing this book, I was trying to understand the origins of cool. And it goes back in a number of ways I traced it back into a number of places. But almost always it goes into African American culture, and a lot of the directions are how to stifle rage and violence to survive during slavery and the times thereafter. I quote Langston Hughes, a poem of Langston Hughes. I play it cool and dig all jive. That's the reason I stay alive. And I think that's a lot of what we think of as cool is a kind of armoring or a kind of, it's cool is the one thing money can't buy. It's the thing the slave owners could own a body, but they couldn't own the cool. Couldn't own the soul.
The Igbo slaves were the Igbo people that they tried to get for slaves, not all of them, some of them were so cool they would slit their throats before they could even be taken captive. That's way cool. That's beyond, I'll never be that cool.
Yeah.
You know, but I have a lot of respect for that. Talking with Lewis McAdams on Birth of the Cool, Beat, Bebop, and the American Avant-Garde. I'm Paul Nelson. The original equation of cool might be spelled out as bebop plus existentialism equals cool.
Yeah, I tried to, it's slightly facetious, but I said that Miles Davis, his first girlfriend was Juliette Gréco, who was really the voice of disaffected French youth right after World War II. I mean, we know her in America much for her later life when she was Daryl Zanuck's girlfriend and made a bunch of entirely forgettable American movies. But in 1946, she was a 20-year-old girl with a trench coat with a collar turned up and long straight hair and a beret, really establishing a woman's bohemian style for generations to come. And she sang songs of poets like Boris Vian and this very world-weary voice. And when Miles Davis came to Europe for the first jazz festival after the war, they met and fell in love. And it was a kind of a long-distance relationship that lasted for 3 years. And as I say in the book, if they'd had a child, if it was the child of bebop and existentialism, was the birth of the cool.
Yeah. And the notion that the American jazz musician, the bebop musicians, not the swing musicians,
right,
not Cab Calloway or something like that, but the beboppers took the beret and took the attitude that they were serious artists.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction of that time. Dizzy Gillespie said that the only reason he really got into a beret was because his kind of hat he could stuff in his pocket when he was on stage. But I think it was more than that for him and for Thelonious Monk and others. Is that they adopted this? And I talk about this in the book. When Jean-Paul Sartre came to New York, the you know, some people would say the father of existentialism, came to New York right after the war. I mean, really, right when the war, before the war was really over, right after the liberation of Paris, and cut a real swath in magazine articles and a kind of public welcome in New York and in the cities of the Eastern Seaboard. And it was right about that time that bebop was surfacing. I mean, it had gone on all through the war, and it really didn't come downtown until the war was almost over. And these guys adopted that style, and it was a way of saying, I think, we're not just entertainers, but we got something to teach. I mean, there's titles of some of the early bebop tunes had Bopplicity and Move and things. They had a sort of almost academic air, like there was something that they wanted to lay out for people.
Or anthology.
Yeah, exactly.
And the notion behind both existentialism and bebop, I think, is about freedom.
Yeah, I think it's freedom in an essentially uncaring world. You know, and I think that so much of our of post-war American culture was shaped by the war and then the reaction to it. And the heroes of cool, the people that established what people have thought of since as cool, were people that weren't in the war, that didn't take part, that were too weird, too queer, too out of it, too alienated to even be part of it. And so there was a bohemian culture in the United States before, but it wasn't about cool. I mean, cool was a stance in the face of massive, not just indifference, but the emblem is Lester Young, who is perhaps the man who invented the current the usage that's cool, spending World War II in the brig. You know, after they drafted him, after a guy in a Cab Calloway, an undercover agent dressed as Cab Calloway, arrested him, wearing a zoot suit.
Talk about the essence of uncool, right? Yeah. There. Yeah. Well, Charlie Parker was cool, but Dizzy Gillespie wasn't. He was hip.
Well, I was trying to make the distinction in there between, I mean, to the outside world. At that time, nobody had really heard of Charlie Parker, but Dizzy Gillespie was the guy who was able to, he was to get very together person, he was married to a very together woman, and they were able to move out into the wider culture in a way Charlie Parker was never able to. So within the musicians community, Charlie Parker was cool, but in the outer world where Charlie Parker didn't even exist, Dizzy Gillespie was cool. I mean, it's obviously so much of what's cool is in perceptions of others. I mean, a cool is something that's bestowed by your peers, as Marlene Kim Connor says. It's not something that can be handed down like a hereditary title from father to son.
And once you say you're cool, we realize you're not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the quicksilver nature of cool, is that, you know, as soon as you say something's cool, it's the cool starts to vaporize.
But that notion of the kind of mugging that Diz would do, Charlie Parker would not be caught dead doing that kind of stuff.
Right,
and that's what cool is, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, Dizzy Gillespie was hip in the sense that he was wise to the ways of the world, and he knew that mugging was one of the ways that he could make a living doing what he did. I mean, at a time when Charlie Parker was, you know, playing for people putting a dime in a cup in the front of the stage, Dizzy Gillespie was working, owned an apartment, and had a life, you know, and Charlie Parker was never able to accomplish that.
Yeah.